Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also are rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on A2Zen.fm. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Lots of opportunities, as I say each week, for you to find out about what is going on with our guests, what they have to offer, and we certainly would encourage you to check them out. We are not advertising them in that respect. That is not the purpose of this program. I know that it may sound that way. I don't endorse any of the programmers. I just encourage you to check them out. I might find them interesting, fascinating, and I've read their books and really am excited about what they have to offer as far as the new paradigms for a new world and looking for those new ways of living. And I just want you to check them out. I think you will benefit greatly. So we, again, encourage you to do that. This is a program that comes your way every Saturday, and we are looking for those new ways of living, trying to give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And to that end, one of the dreams that, of course, I have been involved with now for probably the last 7, 8, 9 months or more, of course, since I've shared with you the loss of my wife's canine companion and protector, Connor, back in August of 2012, and the newly acquired, if you will, or brought into our family, newly adopted, Angus, who is a King Shepherd, a Black King Shepherd. Everybody that talks, that sees him, sees his paws and says he's going to be huge, bigger than my dog even. And so we're actually looking for that. And I'm looking for a saddle. Just kidding. But he is coming along really, really well, really enjoying having him as part of our family. And I know he is having a good time as well. So that is one of the dreams that has come true for me. In addition to learning ways of relating both to him and he to me. That's part of the process that we're all going through, is learning how to relate to one another. And we encourage you to find ways of doing that. It is all about relationships. It's all about you and me together. This, I've used the term lifeboat, that we are in a lifeboat and you're all welcome. But we are moving on to new ways of doing things. We are moving on to finding, and everybody has a piece of that puzzle. And one gentleman, actually one couple, who has a very significant piece to that puzzle, it now affects me. I am now impacted by the things that they bring to the table. George Campanella is my guest. I beg your pardon. It's Campanelli, and he is my guest, and he and his wife have put together an extraordinary work that deals with those over 50. In particular, Do Not Go Quietly. You can also put that right up next to the exit sign. Do not go quietly. But we're actually dealing with not exiting just yet. We hope we're around for a long time, George. But we're talking about, as we're headed for that exit sign in that doorway, that we are going to, I think it's best epitomized, and you may be familiar with this poem, and I can't recite it verbatim. I never was able to do that real well in school. But it basically says that this life was not meant to be lived where you go through life quietly and you just kind of disappear. You should go sliding down the hill on the seat of your pants with a margarita in one hand and a fistful of chocolates in the other, yelling Yahoo with your body well worn out and tired and ready to go. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure to be here with you. And life is indeed, you know, when you talk about, you know, the 50 and over group, the fact of the matter is, as soon as we come through the entrance, we are actually moving toward the exit, you know?
Yes, I've heard that.
And so it's one of the reasons that, you know, the subtitle of the book is about living consciously and aging wisely.
Yeah.
And I think the younger we begin the process of living consciously, then the larger the probability or possibility of living wisely and aging wisely. But we also believe, and one of the real themes of the book, is that it's never too late or too soon to realign the path you're on, to reconnect with the dreams that you've come here to manifest, that it's always the right moment to get back in touch with that still small voice within that contains the wisdom and the blueprint that can unfold itself in our lives.
Now, this isn't, again, and I think that you have encompassed every person on the planet, because this is not exclusively, or even in a loose way, this isn't just for the AARP generation, you know, those on Social Security, those who are planning on retire, which, by the way, George, and I'm guessing you and I are maybe along the same wavelength here. I've said this even in my 20s. That I have no plans on retiring, that they will have to peel my cold dead carcass off of the console because I don't plan to stop doing these kinds of things, that, whether it's this program or whatever comes down the road in the next 50 years for me. I have, by the way, I have to outlive my great-grandmother who lived to be 100. And I was saying I was going to outlive her when she was in her 90s, and she kept getting older and older, and I'm going, and she's making it really hard. So I've got a long way to go, George.
Well, I think we all have a long way to travel, I don't know that it matters the number of years that we're on the journey.
I think
the quality of that experience. And so when you speak, as you just did, Richard, I can feel that energy and passion that you have for what you do. And that is why we talk about people connecting to their dreams. Because when people are doing the things that bring them joy, that use their talents and skills, that allow them to achieve some of the things that are critical and important to them, that passion and energy and enthusiasm naturally comes out. And study after study shows that people who are engaged and involve live longer, happier lives. You know, for a while, one of the statistics that was rather staggering was that a number of people who retired tended to pass away on Monday mornings, that there was a correlation between a kind of hanging up one's cleat and giving up on one's life. That's not necessary. And the truth is, you know, AARP has been around for a long time and has done any number of things that support people. And yet their fundamental message is about a way of life that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, it's not that there aren't a number of retired people, but in this world, a lot of people who finish one career begin another, whether it's an avocation, whether it's a choice, or whether it's a necessity. People do a lot of things. And a lot of times when they're finished with that thing that they felt like they had to do, they go back and brush the cobwebs off those paint brushes, or they take out that notebook filled with ideas, or they take up that musical instrument, or they go out into the garage or workshop and they get back to tinkering with that idea, that formula, that whatever. Some of them, some folks who always wanted to coach or teach or mentor do that. So I think you're right. The world today is filled with people. What are you retiring from? Life?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I remember an experience I had with my father. He's 82 this year. And when he turned 70, it was probably more exciting for me than it was for him, only because I was going, I'm like, Dad, 70 is like, this is so cool. I mean, you know, for me, it was cool. And so I asked him at the dinner table that evening, I said, Dad, so how does it feel to be 70? He says, well, I didn't expect to live this long, but I am glad I'm here. And he still lives in the Phoenix area. And one of his joys, of course, is keeping the home cooled to a nice 72 degrees year round and being comfortable. And that's wonderful. That's he wants to be comfortable. He has no intention of moving to a cooler climb. That's where they're going to stay. But it was real interesting as I have gotten older, and I am now in my 50s, I'm communicating with them quite literally on a different level.
Yes.
And I had an experience back in September of 2012 where I met with them, with my wife, at a restaurant in Los Angeles. And we sat, because they were visiting, and thought, well, we'll come down, we'll visit you, catch up a little bit. And so we were sitting and chatting and going on and on and on. And I began to share some of my ideas, which, you know, maybe might be a little controversial, but I was doing nothing more than I do here. Hey, George, here's my idea. I'm putting it on the table. What do you think of this? And you would do the same with me. But I didn't get that kind of a reaction from my father. It was, I actually became attacked. But the reason I say that I'm relating to them on a different level is because I didn't shift into the child mode. Oh, my God, my dad is upset with me and I need to shut up over here. I knew where I was coming from. And again, it was that I'm just throwing out ideas. What do you think? And well, of course, now I know what he thinks. But I thought, I'm gonna try it again. So I threw out another idea and I got the same reaction. Again, I did not shrink into that childhood mode. Because I knew, not that I was right. It wasn't about being right. It was that I knew that where I was coming from, I was okay with. And if that was his reaction, it was okay too. Now, he came to me several weeks later and apologized for that reaction. And I, hey, no big deal. It's all right. Thank you for apologizing. But I think that a lot of us who still have their parents, they're still alive, a lot of times we still relate to them in those modes, whereas we're all adults now.
Yes.
All right? And we are all working towards some kind of common goal of a better life for all of us. And that getting stuck in that childhood place, or any other place for that matter, that really does get in the way.
It does. And I think that on the other side of the coin, you know, there's a gentleman, an author, storyteller, mythologist by the name of Michael Mead. And I don't know if you've come across him, but he talks about the latter stages of existence. And he defines defines the demographics into two groups, olders and elders. Olders, in his definition, are people who have aged chronologically, but they haven't necessarily done the work of expanding their consciousness, moving beyond some of their limitations, following their dreams or their destiny. So they tend to be stuck in place, someplace along the path,
mm-hmm.
whereas elders are people who have stayed in the game of their own well-being, expanded consciousness, tested and discarded beliefs that don't serve them any longer, kept in touch with the wisdom of that inner voice that kind of guides us even when reason tells us that's not the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And these people have earned their stripes as elders. They're the ones with the kind of wisdom that the world really needs, and that indigenous tribes and ancient societies used to call upon to assist them in the business of guiding their states or their tribes. So,
yeah.
You know, there are a lot of people, you know, age doesn't necessarily bring wisdom, you know. Sometimes it just brings a repetition of a series of continual obstacles.
Right.
You know?
I have to wonder sometimes if, and I really did appreciate this, at the age of 21, I was conversing with some people in the studio after an interview, and I was still asking questions. And at the time, I wasn't sure what to make of it. And then when I got into my 30s, I thought, I wonder if this, if I can keep up the pace. And then when I got into my 50s, I thought, I wonder if maybe they did me a disservice by telling me this. Because at the age of 21, at that young age, and I was doing these kinds of interviews, they said to me, you are wise beyond your years. And I often wonder if I would be able to keep pace. You know, okay, now I'm going to get older. Is my wisdom going to continue to grow, stay a leap or two ahead of the chronological age kind of thing? But what you're saying, I think, is extremely, extremely potent in that if we don't start observing, and this is one of the things that one of my regular guests shares with us when we talk about astrology and Mercury in retrograde, and everybody goes, gets shivers up their spine and gets scared. Oh, my God, Mercury in retrograde. And she uses the definition that it's a time of observation, self-observation, and that if we don't do that, how are we supposed to evolve spiritually, let alone on any other level?
It's true. And it's one of the reasons in Do Not Go Quietly, we spend a lot of time. Yes, it's a clarion call. Yes, it's a reaching out, an invitation to get engaged in the process of life, to make right our relationship with the world while we still have time. But one of the things that we suggest is that rather than just jump up out of the chair and rush out into the world and inflict upon it some of the limitations that we carry, one of the things that this time of life allows us is the opportunity to do precisely what you were suggesting about Mercury in retrograde. Mm-hmm. It's to observe, it's to listen, it's to evaluate, and to feel into how are we doing, what is incomplete, what are the things that we could do to create greater balance and harmony within ourselves so that our interaction with the world is more constructive, more positive, more uplifting. In that way, the second half of life is really an incredible time not just to prepare ourselves for what lies ahead, but also to look back and make things right.
Mm. Now, you and your wife have established a new, I'm going to refer to it as a new country. It stems from the title, the subtitle of one of the Star Trek episodes or movies called The Undiscovered Country.
Uh-huh.
A different premise, but still the same kind of verbiage. But it's called The Age Nation.
Yes.
Tell us the how it came about and the why.
Well, both Sedina and I made passages with both sets of our parents. The latter stage of their aging and then their deaths. We had been, both Sedina and I, blessed throughout our lives to have really terrific health and we functioned well in the world, and we arrived at this point where, for the first time, because of the support and the needs that our parents had, we encountered the healthcare system from a different perspective, and we encountered the life care system from a different perspective. And frankly, we were shocked. We were shocked that aging didn't have a blueprint, nor was there a blueprint for individuals like us who were becoming their care givers, not in on a daily basis, but who became responsible for their well-being in the way that they had been responsible for our well-being as children. Really, Richard, it was a shocking, troubling experience. And although we made a commitment in this instance, my sister and I made a commitment to ensure the fact that our mother and father would stay in their home and they would receive whatever care was needed. We found it enormously challenging, and remarkably expensive, and in the end, in some ways, not even the best choice for them. So, and Sedina had similar experiences with her parents. We began to ask ourselves, you know, what was going on. We began to do some research. We were asked to speak at some conferences, an international conference on aging in Australia and some other conferences in different places in the United States. FATE also introduced us. We do some consulting, and they introduced us to some clients that had aspects of their organizations that dealt with aging populations. And it became clear to us that as a nation and as a world, we were on a kind of collision course with our future. Before that, we had no knowledge of this thing called the demographic revolution. We had no idea that the population in the U.S. and in most of the industrial countries in the world was aging, and that that was being offset by a decline in the birth rates in many of these countries. So here you have an aging population, increasing longevity, decreasing birth rates, and a shrinking tax base as a result. In other words, fewer people entering the workforce to pay taxes and support the needs of a large number of people moving into the latter stages of their lives. Mm-hmm. And so those factors, the personal experience with our parents and the awarenesses that started to come, made us create this organization called Age Nation and an affiliated nonprofit called the Age of Empowerment with the intention of finding ways to inform, educate, inspire, engage, and seek solutions for the challenges this demographic group will have here in the United States and eventually around the world.
It sounds to me, the way you've laid this out, that just to use one of the pillars, that the current economic structure and system based upon the parameters you've just laid out is absolutely 100% non-sustainable, and that we have to come up with some new way, if you want to call it a new economic way, I just call it a new way of living, because it sounds to me like being the consumer producer or the consumer producerism that is our economic structure around the world in the industrialized countries, again, it's not sustainable.
Well, and it's especially not sustainable because we've altered some other dynamics within the culture. For a long time, people were born, grew up, and died in the same geography. Mm-hmm. Families tended to stay together in the same region. Now, that still is true to a certain degree, but there's also this massive spreading out that's happened. In rural areas, younger people leave in search of opportunity in urban environments. People that were born in one area of the country, even if elements of their family remain in that area, they have moved away to other parts of the country. So we no longer have a core central family unit that actually took on elder care as a natural part of being a family.
Mm-hmm.
Now the parents are in New York, the kids are in California or Florida or wherever they happen to be, and so there needs to be a different support structure in place. So that's a factor that's causing enormous challenge. the other, and when you refer to the consumerism of our world, we often believe that if we stay between the lines and we do our job and we pay our monthly fees for insurance or health care plans or whatnot, that when we need it, it will be there. Well, the truth of the matter is that weight that we're talking about, 50% of our population over 50 in the United States and in a lot of the industrialized countries, eventually over the next several decades, that puts this enormous burden on a system that wasn't really designed for it. The insurance business and the pharmaceutical business and even now the hospital business, these are businesses designed to make a profit. So it's like they bet against the odds,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You pay them a certain amount of money, and they have their actuarial tables and whatnot. And up until recently, it was a highly profitable business because the amount that you paid in versus the amount that you would pull out, you paid in more, and they made more money on the investment of that money that you paid in.
Mm-hmm.
But now all of a sudden there's a conversation emerging in our culture that's about a thing called object risk. And that means that the risk of the individual outliving the profitability of the system is much greater.
Mm-hmm.
And so these systems are looking ahead, and they're saying to themselves, what the heck are we going to do when this enormous number of people get into this demographic, especially the way the current healthcare system is structured? You see, we don't talk about death in our healthcare system. Do you know, Richard, that the average human being spends between 70 and 90% of all of the money they spend on health care in their lives in the last year of their lives, and sometimes in the last several months of their lives?
Wow.
You know that?
That's extraordinary.
$500 billion dollars a year is spent on end-of-life medical treatment and drugs, and a preponderant amount of that is completely unnecessary.
You know, it's interesting because I've had to deal with this in the last 10 or 15 years with life insurance in particular, but health insurance as well,
mm-hmm.
in trying to get certain treatments. And they were wellness or preventative health and support
right.
in that regard, and the insurance companies won't cover it until you. It's kind of like I have this little tiny cyst and I can feel it in my arm. Oh no, we won't cover you. We won't cover any exams or anything on that until it develops into something so massive. It's
right.
now cancer. It's now eating up my body. Oh, we'll pay for that. And now my feeling is, I could be dead wrong, you know more about this than I do, that the insurance companies, as we're speaking in this regard, are going to start taking a look at that and going, you know what, it might be in our best interest, including profitability for us, if we start paying for some of this preventative maintenance and wellness therapy that everybody's talking about. Because if we don't, what you just said, they're going to be flipping the bill for 6 months to a year or more to the end of this individual's life. They can't afford to do that because you don't have the population that's supporting them because, as you just said, the birth rate is declining.
Yes. So now I think the more conscious insurance companies and the more conscious healthcare systems, you know, a lot of the systems in the U.S. are called vertical healthcare systems, and they provide insurance and hospitals and medication and doctors, you know, they cover the whole gamut.
Mm-hmm.
The wiser and the more conscious amongst them recognize this object risk, and they're beginning to speak to this topic you were addressing called total health.
Yeah.
And it is a requirement.
I mean, my father taught me when I was very young in regards to the cars that we had, and he was no auto mechanic or what have you, but he knew enough to know, look, if you take the car in every 3,000 miles, change the oil, have the fluids checked, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the car is going to last a lot longer than if you don't. So what do I do now with the vehicles that we drive? Now, of course, it's 5,000 to 7,000 miles, and that's still fine because now they're made better. But I take it in every cycle, and I have the fluids checked, and I do the regular 60 and 90,000 mile maintenance, you know. And yeah, maybe it'd be $200 or $300, but think about it. What if I don't do that? And then I get to a point where I have a major catastrophic failure of one of the systems of the car, and now it's not $200 or $300, it's now $2,000 or $3,000, or I've got to buy a new car. And with a body, you don't get to buy a new body. We're not there yet. You know, you have to stay in the body you're in until it completely wears out. So it just seems to me, that to me is a more sustainable and logical way of doing things. This is fascinating. I want to come back and talk more about the book. I want to talk about you and your wife and how you went down this particular path, because it is not a path for everyone to go down. By the same token, we're all going down that same path, as you mentioned at the outset of the program, that when we walk through the entrance door, we're headed for the exit door, and we need to start thinking about that. And by the way, death, or transitioning, if you will, is one of my favorite topics, and I'll share that with you when we come back. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I am Richard Dugan, and we will be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Understanding? Yes, that is what it's all about. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and my guest is the co-author, along with his wife, Sedina, George Capanelli, and he is with us via the phone lines. And you happen to reside in the area of Santa Fe, New Mexico, right?
That's true.
But you and I shared a common stomping ground for a while, and that was the areas around Phoenix and surrounds, and places up north as well. And when I was a kid growing up, beautiful place. And of course, they have a number of different retirement communities, Fountain Hills and Sun City West and so forth. But I find it really interesting that you probably don't see a lot of people under 40 or under 30 all that interested in kind of getting on this bandwagon, if you will, in spite of what you said about how, hey, when we walk through the entrance door, we're heading for the exit door, we're all going that direction, and we all need to kind of get together and work things out so that while we're here, we can do more than survive. We can, and I think this word is starting to come into vogue a little more, we can thrive.
Yes.
Utterly thrive.
Well, and I believe that the real question that we have to address is we live in a land without even trying to trace the roots of this tradition, but we live in a country that has become youth obsessed and age averse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of it is just the consumerism, the consumer premise that our economic system is based upon, because largely younger people tend to be a little bit more inexperienced and a little bit more easily manipulated in some ways. You know, they're drawn and attracted to the baubles and the beads. So as a result, as a result of all that, what happens is that the advertisers and the organizations in our world tend to perpetuate that myth of youth. And as a result, we find ourselves in a very awkward time, because if you're age averse and you're unwilling to look at life ahead, then some of the values of society become corrupted. You know, it's grab everything you can now while you can. Don't worry about the environment or our ecology. Don't worry about our natural resources. Just do life now.
Eat, and, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die.
Yeah, and you know, that hardly speaks to the concept of indigenous tribes that looked at things and made decisions based on seven generations, you know, and that who recognized that their actions and their the things that they did today would affect people for a long time, that they had to be stewards and caretakers. Well, in a youth-obsessed, age-averse world, the future doesn't appear to have consequence, and that's a pretty serious thing. And partly that's happened because those of us who are aging have abdicated. Instead of modeling behavior for the future, what we've done is we have done something really stupid. We're pretending that we don't age. Instead of owning the changes that happen physiologically and emotionally and in our lives, we find ourselves almost walking into the future backward.
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because almost a year ago, I injured my I'm right-handed, and the relevance will be apparent in a moment. I injured my elbow, and I could not bend my right hand to shave. Now, I shave my head. I am bald, as well as my face. Well, I couldn't raise my hand to do this, so I went on for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and it was coming in. I'm thinking, I haven't grown a beard for like 30 years. I wonder what it looks like now. Well, I found that the hair on the top of my head I didn't care for, so I kept shaving that off, but I kept the beard, and it has a lot of gray in it, as well as brown and so forth, and salt and pepper, I guess you might say. And people would say to me, "You look younger." And I'm thinking, how does a person look younger with gray from a clean-shaven face? I'm not arguing with them. Hey, I'll take it. But I thought that was a real interesting observation on their part. And I've kind of stared in the mirror from time to time. Like, yeah, well, it looks different. I don't know about younger, but it looks different. But I think that one of the other aspects, too, that you talk about is that our preoccupation, almost narcissistic preoccupation with age, aging. You know, we talk about, oh, well, I'm chronologically, I'm 53. You know, but I feel 17 inside this vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
But I also recognize the vehicle can't do the things it did when it was only 17 years old and only had 150,000 miles instead of 563,000 miles.
Uh-huh.
But I find ways to get things done in other ways that won't injure the vehicle, damage it where it needs to be repaired and what have you. But I notice that in our society, In the West in particular, and maybe more specifically in the United States, we're just inundated. If we are television watchers in particular, we're just inundated with this whole concept. Now, that used to be the prevailing thought when I was in my 20s and I was watching TV, and people used to say the same thing. And so I guess I'm curious as to how you and your wife speak to all of the demographics in such a way as to getting them to understand that we are all in this together, regardless of the physical chronological age of the vehicle, of the body?
Well, first of all, you know, the old cliche about leading a horse to water.
Okay.
The truth of the matter is, the best that we can do is to speak as honestly and as directly to those who are willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And so those who are most receptive to listening are those who are standing on the edge of that shift, really, or who are already in the shift of moving into the second half of their lives, in some cases the third act of their lives, you know. So that's really that's one of the places we begin. We talk to people who are who recognize that aging is a reality, and that they understand that there are a variety of choices they can make at this stage of their lives. They can, in fact, evaluate their priorities. They can evaluate how they use their resources, and they can evaluate where they are relative to the dreams that they've had about what they want to do and accomplish in this lifetime. So we begin there. And the more people who are in this demographic who start to wake up more, speak honestly about their victories as well as their defeats,
mm-hmm.
And all of that, then the more culture begins to absorb that message instead of the forever young message.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the Hotel Marigold as a movie.
Yes.
100 million people saw that film. Now all of a sudden we begin to see other films come out like Quartet and other movies. More and more people. There's a gentleman by the name of James Twyman who is looking to create kind of a new kind of senior cinema in America. Age Nation has an intention to do the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like there's a bubbling up that's happening.
Yeah.
And along the way, just like you talked about the wisdom that people commented on when you were in their 20s, there are a lot of very wise young people who are on the planet. It is said that that there's greater connectivity between the millennials and the boomers or young elders than between any of the groups of people that are between them.
Hmm.
You know, so
fascinating.
Our book is practical, it's inspiring, it's filled with stories about people who do extraordinary things and have done them in latter stages of our lives. You know, a lot of us think, I'm 40 or 45 or 50 and the game's almost over. I mean, the game is just beginning.
Yeah.
When you look back through history, a number of the people we honor and rever didn't even begin to get to the real meat of their lives and some of their great accomplishments until they were much older.
I find, and this is a subject that has also interested me to no end, and that is, and I was even asking this question in my 30s as well as in my 40s, and that is this business of leaving a legacy. Now, my parents, who are in their early 80s, late 70s, have left an awesome legacy with the six of us. And then our respective, now I have no children, but I have a brother and four sisters who all have, well, I think who most have children. including a grandchild. My parents are great grandparents. So you want to talk about a legacy? They've done that. They have done their part, not only in physically leaving behind, if you will, all of these human beings, but in terms of what they've taught us. And I say that because it was just recently that I received a copy of both of their wills. I am not named in the will. Now, I don't say that with any judgment. I've said this to them directly. I've already received from you more than I could possibly ever have you give me or bequeath me in any will. I don't need any more things. You have already given me the greatest gift that any human being could give. And I'm not saying that you gave me life. That's cliche and it's trite in my opinion. It's what they've taught me. It's what I've learned from them. It's the support and the encouragement, especially through the tough times. That is what no one can ever take away from me. I don't have to pay any inheritance taxes on. And I'll have that with me. And I hope that with my life, I'm leaving some kind of legacy behind too, even though I don't have any physical children. I'm hoping that maybe through these programs, through the people that I come in, and that's the way I look at it. Every person that I come in contact with that I can make some kind of an impression on, I have now left a piece of me behind.
Yes, you are. And you have. And I think when we talk legacies, there is the fact that these generations, older Gen Xers, boomers, and elders, are going to leave behind the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the world, physical wealth, mm-hmm. you know? And so when we think legacy, we tend to think money and, you know, valuables and the like. Mm-hmm. But what you're referring to is a different kind of legacy. What you're referring to is a legacy of character, a legacy of quality, a legacy of understanding, a legacy of perception about the world. And in many ways, I know that that kind of legacy is invaluable. We can, burn through the other kind of
mm-hmm.
legacy.
Yeah.
But that's also a shift that I think is beginning to happen and has to happen. That is, we need to begin to revalue, to respect, as Sedina often says, to respect is kind of like to relook, using the old concept of spectacles, you know.
Yeah.
But to relook at life, and that's what this time of life is designed to be.
Yeah.
It's a time to remember and relook and reevaluate, so that we don't stay on automatic, but rather we get back on manual.
Yeah, and to continue that automotive metaphor, the word retire only refers in my dictionary to putting new set of tires on my car.
Sure. Yeah, and it's an outstanding image because it's true. We don't retire anymore. We reinvest.
Yes.
We reinvent.
Yeah.
We retread. We do all of these wonderful things that are so essential to quality of life.
Yeah.
And so, rather than hanging up our cleats, and we talk again a lot about this in the book. Rather than hanging up our cleats, we're really putting on new kinds of shoes to do new kinds of things.
Exactly. I want to share with our listeners, if you don't mind, something that you wrote, and then I have a question for you following that. This is an excerpt from the book, and it basically reads, "Not quietly. No, we will not go quietly, not meekly into this or any other night. We who cheer with Martin when Martin marched and who first heard Rachel Carson's call, we who lost our heroes to hate, and tried to find ourselves in love, we who died at Kent State, and cheered when the wall came down, we will not go quietly, not meekly, into this or any other dark night. We who mourn the loss of America's grace and then celebrated the rebirth of hope, we will not go quietly. We will harvest the wisdom of our lives and bay at the moon of new possibility. We will dance to life's mysteries and forge a path of renewed promise for ourselves and those who come after us. We who hold in our hands and hearts the power to resurrect the dream. We who stood on the front lines before and are called to do so once again will not go quietly, not meekly, into this or any other night. And that is your work, George Campanelli. And when I first saw the title of the book, it brought to mind another poem, which I am not going to read because it's much longer. But I'm wondering if that was an inspiration for you, the poem by Dylan Thomas, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night.
Well, the poem was an inspiration, but actually why he wrote it was even more of an inspiration, in that Dylan Thomas was really talking about his father, about lost opportunities. It was a poem about regret and sadness and disaffection. And by comparison, the story that we tell and what that poem that you just read by me is all about is about opportunity. It's about not regretting, but rather looking ahead and anticipating, and in that anticipation, finding new alternatives, new directions, new probabilities. The do not go quietly for us is different than the do not go gently, because for us, we want people to wake up. We want olders to become elders. We want those of us who have stepped off the path of our own dreams to step back on them. We want people who have the wisdom of their experience, instead of just talking about the good old days, to use that experience as grist for the mill, mm-hmm. to turn into real wisdom that other people can benefit from.
Yeah, well, I do remember the good old days. They were pretty darn good, and I'm very old now.
I think that's something that I think all of us can take to heart. And by the way, you can also go to donotgoquietlythebook.com, and you can read more about this work, this movement. I'd be fair to say that it is a movement, right?
Yes, and that's also what folks can find out more about on agenation.com, which is about that side of our work. Whether they read the book or whatever your listeners do, I just wish from the bottom of my heart that they stop, get quiet, listen to that inner voice, because that inner voice is so much stronger. In our book, we talk about the difference between believing and knowing. Ooh. And it is knowing, ultimately, it's our knowing that exists inside of us that is our truest guide. And so that's the wish that we have for all of your listeners. And if they, you know, are moved to pick up the book and explore, we'd love to hear from them. And just
absolutely.
Grateful.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to let our listeners know that there is more to this interview if you're listening on the radio, if you're listening to A2Zen.fm. Go to RichardDugan.com, listen to the entire interview. And George, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to share this time with us. This has been extraordinary, and I look forward to having you in studio if you and your wife find yourself in the Santa Barbara area. We'd love to sit down and talk with you again.
It's a pleasure, and I thank you for being available, for doing the work that you do, and for allowing us to share some of the work that we do with the folks who listen.
Now, you're quite welcome. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest again has been George Campanelli. He's the co-author along with his wife, Sedina, and they have written, Do Not Go Quietly. Whatever you do, make a lot of noise. Make a lot of noise. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time, love to Lal.